President Obama delivers his State of the Union address tonight.
What will economists be watching for?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, January 24th.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
President Obama delivers his annual State of the Union address this evening, and you can expect to hear his plans to boost job training, rebuild infrastructure, and help underwater homeowners. But the reality is the president doesn't have the political support in Congress to get much past this election year. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
If Congress does nothing, taxes will go up and government spending will come down. Stan Collender at Corvus Communications says with total gridlock, the deficit will get smaller.
But it would also do some quick damage to the economy. You'd have some spending cuts and tax increases just at a time when the economy was starting to recover.
He says the economic recovery is still too fragile and needs congressional coaxing. But most people figure stalemate will stop just about everything.
I actually believe that conventional wisdom may not be correct this year.
Robert Shapiro says that's because of Congress's low approval rating. He was a former campaign advisor for President Bill Clinton.
The members of Congress have got to do something to change the perception that most of them should be thrown out of office, and that means accomplishing something.
He figures the time is right for congressional approval of some economic stimulus projects, like more education and training, and rebuilding the nation's crumbling infrastructure. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
For more on the State of the Union, let's bring in Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So from an economic perspective, what are you going to be watching for tonight?
Well, a couple things. We probably will hear some new initiatives on growth, but most of that should be just stay out of the way. Tax breaks to return and keep it to manufacturing here. This is already happening somewhat in automotive manufacturing, but it won't happen in electronics because cost and flexibility are so much lower in China. There's just no way we can begin to match, but there are other areas where you can. Take away the tax breaks from companies who have moved overseas. At least stop making it easier, and you're losing some good tax revenues there. We're probably going to hear something about tax hikes for the rich. This is the Warren Buffett rule. He says it's unfair that he pays a lower rate than his secretary.
Right.
Of course, Mitt disclosed that he pays 15%. Now, it's a big tax check, but it's a very low tax rate. And the biggest one is going to be the mortgage situation. Housing can't recover until you stem the deficit, the default flood. And that's the ability to refinance all these underwater mortgages. That will help the housing market move ahead.
Well, Julie, a lot of stuff there. But does he have any chance of getting any of that done in an election year?
Well, probably the key thing everybody's going to be focusing on is what can be accomplished. At least this is going to be a populist speech. And long-term deficit reduction is going to be a key thing as well. This is really important because we can lower the amount of debt needed to finance it. That's fiscal health. And the economy, as it recovers, interest rates are going to rise, and the cost of our debt was going to rise. But if you don't apply the spending tourniquet right now when the economy needs it just to revive, and so you're going to see all of the deficit hawks really talking about it, he'll have to address that as well. But can anything be done with compromise? Probably not. It hasn't been achieved in 8 years. It probably won't be now.
Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Well, among the ideas President Obama is expected to announce tonight is a plan to make college more affordable. Currently, less than 40% of American adults have a college degree. But as the price keeps going up, more people are questioning the value of that degree. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
Last year, two sociologists published a book that got a lot of attention on campus. Academically Adrift followed a group of college students to find out what they learned. After 4 years of college, more than a third of them showed no significant improvement on a test of critical thinking and reasoning. It's the sort of thing employers have been complaining about for years.
Overwhelmingly, employers are telling us we need to do better.
Carol Geary Schneider is president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities.
Employers are telling us we're not doing a good enough job on critical thinking, communication skills, problem-solving skills, that we need to get students out there in the real world actually applying their knowledge to real problems.
Schneider is part of a new effort to measure and improve what college students learn. Today, a group called the New Leadership Alliance for Student Learning and Accountability is putting out a set of guidelines for schools. They recommend colleges set goals for what students should know when they graduate and then measure and report the results. David Paris is executive director of the alliance.
We can produce more degrees, but those degrees won't be meaningful. They won't serve the students and they won't serve our society unless they really represent a high level of achievement.
He says schools could use a number of measures, standardized tests like the Collegiate Learning Assessment, retention and graduation rates, as well as portfolios of student work. Jack Rossman is professor emeritus of psychology at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. He says in the past, faculty have resisted efforts to standardize student learning. He says the key is to get them on board early.
Those colleges and universities that have had good success in developing reasonable measures of student learning have had faculty engaged in the process.
Professors may have little choice. The alliance behind the new guidelines says groups representing more than 3,000 colleges and universities have signed on. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney released his tax returns this morning. They show that in 2010, he made about $20 million and paid $3 million in federal income taxes. That makes Romney's effective tax rate around 14%.
But Jeremy, that's a different tax rate calculation than the one you're probably familiar with. For more, we go to Charlie Whelan, a public policy professor at the University of Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's the tax rate we all think we pay?
Most of us look at the marginal tax rate. So over $250,000, if the marginal tax rate is 39%, we say, oh my goodness, I finally make $251,000. And we assume that we are paying 38 or 39% on that entire sum. And in fact, the marginal tax rate changes for each level of your income. So you're probably paying zero income tax on, say, the first $15,000 or $20,000 of your income, and 10% on the next chunk of your income, and 28% on the next chunk. And that high marginal tax rate only kicks in at that last dollop of income.
So can you tell me what other tax rates are out there that maybe better indicate what I actually pay?
The easiest one is just your average tax. We take how much you paid the government, we take your income, and we divide your tax into your income. So if you paid $18,000 on $100,000 of income, your average tax rate is 18%.
And what about the effective tax rate? What are we talking about there?
Well, in that case, you start to get a little more complex. If you're talking about somebody who has a very complex life, like a Mitt Romney, then you want to look at what is the true tax burden, the effective tax burden on your overall income. It can get quite complex when you realize that money gets taken from other places that don't show up on your actual tax return. In the case of Mitt Romney, his effective tax rate, you know, what really goes to the government as a result of his behavior, is almost certainly higher than what shows up on his tax return.
What rate should we be paying attention to? What rate are you most interested in when you look at Romney's tax returns?
I'm actually not terribly interested in any of his rates. That said, I'm very happy that we're having this discussion, because what we need to be talking about isn't particular to Romney. It's, okay, given that we're taxing these different kinds of income at vastly disparate rates, the discussion is, how does that affect our behavior? They're really important questions from an economic standpoint for the country.
Professor Charlie Whelan, thanks.
Thank you.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
The center of attention in the European debt crisis today is in Athens, Greece. The Greeks are trying to avoid a messy default by cutting the amount they owe private bondholders. A deal was put on the table last night, but quickly rejected by European finance ministers. Meanwhile, the Greek government is taking other steps to boost revenues, and journalist John Sarropoulos joins us from Athens with the details. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I guess when you're a country that is in as deep financial troubles as Greece is, you have to pull out all the stops. And it sounds like the first order of business is to release a list of tax evaders.
That's right. The government has finally, after months of saying that it will do so, released a list of 4,000 people, some of whom owe in the hundreds of millions of euros, largely in an exercise of shaming and of showing our European Union creditors that we are doing everything possible to recoup taxes owed.
And shaming and embarrassing people is not the only tactic that Greece is taking to try to make ends meet. What else is going on?
Well, the government is trying to boost its revenues from tourism, which is already responsible for an estimated 20% of GDP. One of the ways it's doing that is inviting film crews to come and shoot scenes in national monuments and archaeological sites. Another way is the attempt to sell off public property, millions, in fact, of acres of land, which could be sold for redevelopment. But really, what a lot of economists are saying is that the key is not to sell off the family silver. The key is to re-stimulate growth in the economy, and it has to be reversed if Greece is going to stand a chance of eliminating its deficit and eventually paying down its debt.
Journalist John Sarropoulos joining us from Athens. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
The biggest solar storm in more than 6 years is blasting the Earth with radiation today. But it's not as scary as it sounds. The solar flares can disrupt communications. For more, we go to Andrew Coates. He's professor of planetary science at the University College of London. Good morning.
Morning.
So can you explain why these solar flares are a problem?
The types of problems it can cause are upsets in computer memories and problems with computer systems on spacecraft and with images on spacecraft. It's not a huge event, but it's something certainly which is worth being aware of.
And what are the risks for me? Is there anything I might notice today?
We depend on spacecraft for so many things. I mean, weather forecasting, of course, but also the GPS positioning on the Earth's surface and communications, radio and TV communications. And, of course, there's lots of material transmitted by satellite. And so some of those things might have effects. It's difficult to actually forecast that, but we'll know when it gets here.
And I've got one more question for you. I understand these solar flares can affect carrier pigeons, and I was wondering if you could explain that to me.
Yeah, the carrier pigeons depend on the Earth's magnetic field for steering. You know, they don't have GPS, of course, but they actually use the magnetic field for getting from A to B. So because during these events, when the Earth's magnetic field is affected, it can deviate by sort of 5 to 10 degrees. So that can actually be enough to confuse carrier pigeons. So it's a sort of an interesting effect which can happen with solar flares.
So let's hope no one's sending either of us messages by pigeon today.
Absolutely. Yes.
Professor Andrew Coates, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A study out this morning from the National Trust for Historic Preservation finds retrofitting an old building almost always saves more energy than framing up a new one, even if the new building is eco-friendly. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
Say you want to build a downtown apartment complex with a cafe and shops. You add solar panels, recycled floors, insulated windows. But if you tear down an existing building to do it, it'll take decades to get any green benefit, says Patrice Fry at the National Trust.
Up to 80 years for a new efficient building to compensate for the environmental impacts that occurred during the construction process.
The new study found that's true for lots of building types, single-family homes to big office parks. Fry says city planners should think about all the energy wasted before they let developers tear down buildings. But the real estate market is moving that way on its own, says Rob Melnick at Arizona State. He says developers are nervous to gamble on new construction, but they like the idea of sprucing up property with an energy-efficient retrofit.
You know, to protect what you have and really to provide the building efficiencies at a lower short-term cost.
Because developers do know people want green buildings. Buyers will pay more for them and renters will stay in them longer. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
This next story is a story about change in the North African Kingdom of Morocco. Not big political change, not massive economic change. Nope, we're talking about gleaming new hubcaps, snazzy paint jobs, souped-up cars, inspired by the MTV show Pimp My Ride. From Casablanca, John Lawrenson has our story.
At a garage on the outskirts of Casablanca, hubcaps gleam and underlighting glows as mechanics fit doors that open upwards like beetle wings. Reclining on the hand-stitched red leather driving seat of a souped-up Porsche, Warda Alami is definitely a fan.
When you are here, you feel hot.
Yes.
Saïd Seban is too, though he drives a Peugeot.
I want my car to be more beautiful and more interesting. I'm having filters put on the engine, which will bump up the horsepower.
Saïd and Warda are part of a new generation that got into tuning because of the long reach of American TV. Mehdi El Kamal, one of Morocco's top customizers, says the TV show Pimp My Ride is a cult series here. It's made car tuning a mass movement, he says, because Moroccans love everything that's showy and luxurious. El Kamal can make your car lower and wider, turn it into a convertible and airbrush your son's portrait on the passenger door. In Morocco, he says, there are still craftsmen who can sew a logo into your seat leather or turn an original car part on a lathe. And repair shops on the edge of almost every town have their own original, customised way of doing things. Moroccan journalist Omar Hadi.
In Morocco, there's a bit of artistry about the way the mechanics work. They haven't had any formal training, so they don't follow rules. They follow their instinct.
So when the sun goes down, you can get into your car and cruise along the Casablanca seafront with the best of them.
There we go, inside here.
In Casablanca, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
It's a nice noise.
Nice noise.
Now, a legitimate excuse for those of you who really, really hate frozen winter days. Turns out you can actually medically be allergic to cold, Jeremy.
Really?
Yep. Researchers have published a new study in the New England Journal of Medicine outlining the condition. USA Today says some people have the allergy. They break out in hives. For others, it's even more serious. There is no word, though, on how common this allergy is. But I do have an idea of what to say next time my editors send me out on some economic impact of icicle story.
I'm allergic to the cold.
Martha Stewart is in legal trouble again, this time for two-timing. Her company, Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia, is being sued by Macy's. The department store says its exclusive agreement to sell a line of Stewart's merchandise was violated when Stewart announced a deal with JCPenney. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
The home products sold with the Martha Stewart label weren't available anywhere other than Macy's. And that's what made them valuable, says retail analyst Faith Hope Consolo.
They get the attention of the market, the consumer, very, very quickly.
Retailers from Target to Kohl's are vying for exclusives with lots of designers and celebrities. Recently, JCPenney announced it would launch a line of stores within its stores selling Martha's home and lifestyle products. And Martha Stewart's company has argued she should be able to sell merch in multiple locations, as other brands like Apple do. In fact, you can buy a Martha Stewart doggy bandana at PetSmart and home office products at Staples. Vincent Kwan is with the Fashion Institute of Technology.
She must have thought it through and said, hey, we're going to create exclusive product again for JCPenney, but very distinct and different from the Macy's product.
But apparently not different enough. Macy's is seeking injunctions on the deal. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Starting February 3rd, kids may have an entirely new experience at the happiest place on Earth. Disney's announced that after decades of strict rules against facial hair, they're going to let employees grow goatees and even beards.
In today's Midday Extra, we look at what this change says about Disney as a company and the times we live in. Here to talk with us about it is Beth Kassab. She's a columnist for the Orlando Sentinel. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Beth, this policy has been in place for a long time. Why is Disney relaxing the rules now?
Well, we've seen Disney slowly relax its dress code over, you know, especially over the last 10 years or so. And the workplace in general has become so much more relaxed today than it used to be. Disney's the world's largest single-site employer, so it makes sense that they would eventually follow.
What was the problem with beards, though? What were they worried about?
You know, the beards originally did not fit into the Disney look. That is the look that Walt Disney himself set out to establish for the company, a very clean-cut, all-American look, and beards did not fit in.
So why do they fit in now?
You know, I think it's, again, just sort of this evolution of Disney, you know, adding a little bit more of a relaxed look. And employees asked for this change, and after what appears to have been years of consideration, the company has relented.
So does this say something about facial hair, too? I mean, are the hipsters winning?
You know, I think they might be a little bit. Now, it should be noted, and I think you mentioned in your intro, that these are very close-cut beards. So this is not a Rip Van Winkle-style beard here. This is very closely cropped, so still very neat-looking.
Is this going to change the face of Orlando in general?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, Disney, you know, you may have noticed a couple years ago, there were some stories. They finally allowed women to have the freedom to not wear pantyhose when they were wearing skirts. So, you know, over time, some of these things have been relaxed. And, you know, you go out to the parks today, and the employees are still very clean-cut, very all-American looking. So I don't think it's really you know, upset the general theme out there.
Plus, beards are probably really warm in Florida and L.A.
Yeah. Well, here in January, considering it's about 80 degrees today, I don't know that a lot of cast members would necessarily want to have beards for warmth. But like you said, I mean, maybe the hipsters are pushing a little bit of a fashion statement there.
Beth Kassab is a local columnist for the Orlando Sentinel. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
And finally, to a dairy farm in Pitfield, Ohio, where the cows, Adrian, have been living the good life for the last 10 months. The owners installed waterbeds for the cows to relax in.
Waterbeds for cows?
For the cows, yes. The farmers tell USA Today the cows' milk has improved and the cows are healthier after living in the waterbeds. But they would like some more sparkling water, please, with lemon when you get a chance. And maybe if you could pass the remote, that would be nice too.
Anything for those cows.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrian Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.